I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opyango Line, a podcast dedicated to the local heritage and unique culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opyango River Valleys. I'm joined today by Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Karen Filipkowski, and Lynn Stewart, all members of the Opyango Readers Theatre. As we approach Robbie Burns Day this coming January 25th, the Opyango Readers Theatre thought it might do something Scottish, but perhaps something a little different than its usual recitations of Robert Burns' wonderful poetry. Something perhaps that celebrates Scottish heritage, but maybe something a bit closer to home. For if you were to travel down the Madawaska River from where we are today in Barry's Bay, you would eventually come to a very curious place, McNab Braeside Township, a place where the mighty Madawaska pours through Iron Prior and into the Ottawa River, but a place nonetheless that boasts a unique connection with not only Scotland, but to those very times when Robbie Burns himself was alive and walking the ancient heather and hillsides of Scotland. Indeed, during Burns's lifetime, there was a young Scottish lad by the name of Archibald McNab, who was 16 years old when that greatest of Scottish poets was finally laid in his grave. But by the time Archibald reached his mid-40s, the McNab, as he liked to style himself, would, under cover of darkness, leave Scotland and eventually land where the Madawaska meets the Ottawa. And boy, did he make a noise once he got here, and not all of it good. For whatever the founder of McNab Braeside Township was in real life, Renfrew County has never been the same since. Now, to be clear, there's nothing quite certain about the factual history of Archibald McNab. Even his official biography is still very much partly truth and partly fiction, for to put it mildly, it is well known and beyond a shadow of a doubt that our most famous local Scot, the McNab, once attempted to establish a feudal serfdom on the lower Madawaska, where McNab Braeside Township still stands today. And he did a pretty good job of maintaining that serfdom for nearly two decades by bamboozling those interested in building that young democracy that would eventually, in 1867, become known as the Dominion of Canada. Today, that McNab is commemorated, albeit for nothing very democratic, in such places as the Waba Cottage Museum and Gardens, nestled along White Lake between our very own towns of Renfrew and Iron Prior. Not to be confused with Scotland's very own Iron Prior and Renfrew. Indeed, if you haven't made it down to the Waba Cottage Museum and Gardens, you're missing out on much of Renfrew County's formative 200-year-old local history. Few characters, if any, match the Laird of McNab's unique character, and even fewer people exit the Waba Cottage Museum and Gardens without shaking their heads, confounded by the wild and crazy things the McNab once tried to pull off here in Renfrew County. As some of you know, in two short years, the Waba Cottage Museum and Gardens will be celebrating the bicentenary of the Laird's infamous 1825 attempt to create his feudal lordship along the Madawaska. But if some old documents can still be believed, the story of how Archibald McNab got here is no simple narrative. Indeed, it has all the wild drama and Hollywood movie-making potential of a great Walter Scott novel. Here's part of the old biography read by Jeff Bowman and purportedly written late in the 19th century by Alexander Fraser. But, according to those in the know at the Waba Cottage Museum and Gardens, it was actually written in the 1870s by Dugald C. McNab. It tells more than a wee bit about your man, Mr. Archibald McNab, and his dramatic escape from Scotland 200 years ago, this very year.
It was a genial evening in 1823. The sun was casting long shadows from the glorious old pines of Leaney Woods, and the baronial mansion of Dr. Hamilton Buchanan reflected in gorgeous splendor the last rays of the setting sun. A horseman had just fastened his pony at the outskirts of the park, nigh to the Callander Road, on the Loch Erin side of the village, and now on foot, and enfolded in a tartan plaid so as almost to conceal his person, was threading the mazes of the wood, and stealthily approached the house of Leaney. This was Archibald McNab, the last chieftain of the McNabs, who had that morning, for the last time, left his paternal estate of Canal on the banks of Loch Tay, to take refuge with his cousin, the last Buchanan of the ancient house of Arnprior. Their mutual grandfather, Buchanan, the chief of Arnprior, had been beheaded at Carlisle for participation in the rebellion of 1747, and he it was whom Sir Walter Scott took for his beau ideal, in the person of Fergus MacIvor, in his elegant romance of Waverley. The estate of Leeny was all that was left to the Buchanans out of their immense property, as the Arnprior estates were confiscated to the crown for high treason on the part of their chief. The affairs of MacNab were at the time we write, 1823, thought to be involved beyond extrication. His estate was mortgaged to the Earl of Breadalbane, and even now the officers of the law were on Archibald MacNab's track to enforce on his person, by arrest, a decree of the Court of Session. And in order to get possession of the title deeds of the Dochart and Connell estates and deliver them to MacNab's unrelenting creditor, John, Earl of Breadalbane. By a postern gate, MacNab entered the noble halls of Leeny and was there met and welcomed by his cousin. Their meeting was most affecting, and there stood the last representatives of two of the most ancient houses in Scotland, Connell and Arnprior. Both had suffered for Charles Edward. Both had lost kindred, lands, and prestige for Prince Charles. But now both were in different circumstances. The last chief of the MacNabs was humbled. No more was the haughty MacNab with his grants beside him and the lions of Dochart close by his side. Rather, MacNab was dejected, impoverished, and ruined, while Dr. Hamilton was wealthy and able and willing to assist his unfortunate and once powerful kinsman. At that period, MacNab was in the prime of manhood as he had just passed his 42nd year. With a melancholy countenance and with an aspect of despair, he unfolded all his griefs to his relative. About 10 days previously, the Court of Session had given the decree and granted a caption. To disobey was to forfeit his liberty till compliance was made to the order of the highest civil tribunal in Scotland. To obey was to lose every opportunity of redeeming his estate and to throw away forever any chance of reclaiming it. Long and anxious was the consultation between the two gentlemen. At length, it was resolved that the chief should start for America from an English port, found a settlement, retrieve his lost fortunes, and return to his native land in better times. Hard was the struggle, but at length his resolution was taken, and everything was prepared for his departure by next day's afternoon mail. In the meantime, the king's messengers, with the writ of caption, had gone to Connell, and finding that their prey had escaped, betook themselves to Callander, a village 2 miles distant from Leeny House. In passing through Glen Ogla, they heard that MacNab had passed through early in the afternoon, and naturally supposed that the chief was at Leeny. Arriving at Callander at 4 in the morning, they rested to take some refreshments before proceeding to their more disagreeable task. Fortunately for MacNab, the principal of the king's messengers, a person named Watt, was well known to John McEwen, the head waiter of MacGregor's Hotel, who at once suspected their errand, as the chief's affairs were a common topic of conversation through Perthshire. While the king's men were taking their bread and cheese and whiskey, John McEwen dispatched a stable boy named Scobie by a shortcut to Leeny House to apprise MacNab of his danger. He roused up Dr. Hamilton's butler and told him his errand. The butler instantly hurried to the chief's bedroom. MacNab, having been roused out of a deep sleep and hearing of the impending danger, at once jumped out of bed, drew on his underclothes, threw a plaid over his shoulders, and escaped to the glen in rear of the Leeny House by the back door. Just as he was making his hurried exit, the king's messengers from Stirling thundered at the front entrance. Dr. Buchanan, who was generally called Dr. Hamilton on account of adopting this surname when he came into possession of the Bradovia estate, rushed to the windows. The officers demanded admission. Hamilton sternly refused. They attempted to break the door open, but the doctor leveled a double-barreled gun at their heads and threatened to shoot the first man who attempted to enter. The messengers at once desisted, slid the ring of their batons from one end to the other, swore that they were deforced, and threatened to bring the whole civil powers of Perth and Stirling to their assistance. Dr. Hamilton jeered and laughed at them. At length they departed, vowing vengeance against all parties concerned. Chief MacNab lay closely concealed in the glen all day. Provisions and clothes were sent to him, and at night he again stealthily entered Leany House. A spy had been left in close proximity to the park to watch proceedings, and he saw what had taken place. He was on his way to inform his employers that the bird was trapped. But just as he cleared the park gates and entered the Callander Road, the unfortunate spy was seized by four sturdy Highlanders, gagged and blindfolded, and carried to a lint mill near Loch Labuk, and there kept a close prisoner for 48 hours. He was well used and well fed until his period of incarceration had expired. In the meantime, two faithful servants of Dr. Hamilton had prepared the coach and horses for a long journey. These two were Peter MacIntyre, who died in 1868 at the Calabogie Lake, and John Buchan, who also came to Canada and for many years resided at Point Fortune, a respectable and wealthy farmer. At midnight, MacNab, being well provided with funds and necessaries, bade farewell to his cousin of Leany and set out for Dundee with Buchan and MacIntyre. Every precaution was taken on the road, but it was needless, for the officers of the law were calmly sleeping at the head end of Callander, expecting to hear from their spy, little Johnny Crare, if anything unusual occurred. The chief arrived safely at Dundee, took shipping for London, and thence to Quebec. And the first news Lord Breadalbane and his messengers heard of him was in the public journals of Montreal, of a great dinner and ovation given in Montreal by the Upper Ten to Highland chieftain MacNab. The decree of the Court of Session had no power in Canada. Consequently, MacNab was free. We may also state that Watt remained around Callander for 2 days, searching for little Johnny. At length, the spy appeared and informed them all of what had occurred. There were no telegraphs in those days, and they believed the chief was still in Scotland. And so they made frequent excursions to Quesnel, and they were only undeceived in their suppositions when the news of MacNab's safe arrival on the other side of the Atlantic reached them. Watt, the celebrated king's messenger, was for once outwitted and completely nonplussed.
That was Jeff Bowman reading from the 1899 biography of Archibald MacNab, entitled The Last Laird of MacNab. Of course, not everything written by the Archibald MacNab is gospel. In truth, if you turn to the Dictionary of Canadian Biography, you are apt to be misled, given it bases much of its factual claims upon another dubious biography published in 1938 by Roland Wilde, whose claims may appear to be gospel to some, but not to those down at the Wahba Cottage Museum and Gardens. Then there are the stories told of the MacNab that are nothing but pure fiction. In 1916, Percival C. Cooney published his rather fetching novel based on that 1899 Last Laird of MacNab, but it is just that, a true work of fiction. Put another way, it's a far cry from the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Still, like Walter Scott's gripping good Waverley novels of early 19th century, Cooney's book of romanticized Canadian history is, if anything, a mighty entertaining read. Here's Lynn Stewart reading from Cooney's novel Serfs No More, or The Kinsman.
Archibald MacNab, the titular chief of the clan MacNab and the last living representative of the ancient House of Quesnel, had left the hills and straths of his native Perthshire to seek refuge in the Canadian woods and there establish a new home for the few hundred faithful Highlanders who still clung to the fallen fortunes of their hereditary chief. From the pliant governor of the Canadas, Sir Francis Bond Head, the chief had but little difficulty in securing possession of a township of land, 18 miles square, on the south bank of the Upper Ottawa River. There, on the crest of a bold and terraced acclivity overlooking the lordly Lac des Chats, in all the silent grandeur of its primitive loneliness, the chief built his new home and named it Quesnel Lodge, after the ancestral seat of his fathers in the old land. A few hundred yards to the south, the noisy Madawaska poured its spring floods into the peaceful bosom of the Ottawa, as yet unfurrowed by any craft save the bark canoe of the Indian and fur trader and the bateau of the lumberman. Beyond its blue expanse to the north, miles of endless pine forests lifted away to the low ridge of the Laurentian Hills and the untrodden wilderness of James Bay. To the west of Canull Lodge, and about the little hamlet of Arnprior, near the mouth of the Madawaska, the men who had followed their chief to the new land, even as their grandfathers had followed his grandsire to the fatal field of Culloden, were busy hewing out of the interminable forest homes for themselves and their posterity. Not only McNabs of that ilk were they, but McIntyres, McPhersons, McFarlands, McDonalds, and other of various patronymics, whose fathers, in the breaking up of the clans after Culloden, had, by reason of intermarriage, pledged their fealty to the father of the present chief. By the banks of the brawling Madawaska, along the shores of the purling Dochart, the rude log cabins with their massive stone chimneys grew year by year more numerous. Year by year, the stump-dotted clearings grew wider, and the rent tribute of one bushel of grain per cleared acre grew greater and greater, filling the storehouses of the Laird of McNab full to overflowing. The chief's private estate, Olympian in its magnitude, stretched along the lakefront from the mouth of the Madawaska to the rocky shores of Black Point. His were the mild-eyed deer that amid the stately pines about Canull Lodge raised their antlered heads to gaze unafraid at the passer-by. His, too, were the booms of logs and the mighty rafts of hewn timber that year by year floated idly down the lake to their haven in far-off Quebec. The dream of the McNab had come true. The chief of the ancient clan, once fallen from his high estate, bid fair to win once again to place and power. While at home in Canull Lodge, the chief sat in state as lord of the manor and patriarch of the clan. His gigantic form, clad always in the romantic and picturesque garb of the Highlands, was a frequent and familiar figure on the streets of Montreal and York, as Toronto was known in those days. Tall, broad-shouldered, and erect, a giant in strength and stature, in spite of his 50 years, the McNab ever bore himself with a proud consciousness of the prestige which clung to one of ancient and honorable lineage. Eagerly, the gossips of the two capitals spread the somewhat exaggerated tidings of his wealth, of his ever-growing rent roll, and the faithful and romantic devotion of his clansmen. The semi-annual visits of the McNab to York and Montreal occasioned social events of no slight importance. His lavish prodigality, his charming personality, the brilliancy of the banquets at which he entertained and was entertained by colonial celebrities, the spirit of the time thought but worthy of a generous and whole-souled Highland laird. Even the settlers themselves tacitly approved of a course which heralded to the world the prosperity of the Grant and the greatness of the clan McNab. By what right the laird held the broad acres of his forest domain, by what title he took toll from their yearly toil, the clansmen had never thought to ask. Was he not their chief, whose enterprise and generosity had brought them from a land where the hopeless lot of a crofter had overtaken them? Gladly had they given him a note for the amount of their passage money to be paid at any time within 10 years. Men who had been wont to see, in the old land, a score of pounds paid for a single acre, were but little likely to cavil at the apparent nominal rent of one bushel per acre. Around them was the unbroken forest, where in good time their sons as well could carve out homes for themselves and their children. Rude and harsh as was the life in those pioneer days, a life of unending toil during the short, hot Canadian summer and long, dreary winter, they wrought patiently, with faith in themselves and the future, facing all of the vicissitudes of life with the incessant industry and stolid sternness of their Caledonian ancestry. No mailed baron of the Middle Ages, no prince of the Bourbon or Habsburg line, believed more firmly or more sincerely in the divine origin and eternal permanency of his hereditary prerogatives than the chief of the clan McNab. Himself, he saw as the last of a long line of heroic chieftains. Even as they, in the days of the past, had led the clansmen to many a bloody battlefield, so would he, the McNab of the modern time, lead these, his kinsmen, into the coming days of peace and plenty. Insistent as he was upon his hereditary privileges, the chief was by no means forgetful of his duties. More than one of the clansmen, caught fast in the grip of the law, had him to thank for their freedom or a mitigated sentence. Big Colin MacDonald, who with one blow of his mighty fist had killed a French-Canadian riverman, had escaped with a few years' imprisonment. And Alistair MacNab, falsely accused of theft by a Bytown merchant, had been successfully defended by a lawyer brought from Montreal at the expense of the chief. To the first settlers, it had been somewhat of a shock when they learned that all the timber on their lots, except for that needed for the construction of their farm buildings, was still the property of the chief, though the written leases which stipulated a rent of one bushel of grain per year per acre to me and my successors in the chieftaincy of the Clan MacNab, made no mention of the timber. On this score, but one man had defied the laird, and the offender, Alex Miller, was now a hunted fugitive, wandering no man knew where. To the laird's medieval mind, Miller's offense was unforgivable disloyalty, and he believed that it was his plain duty to the clan, no less than to himself, to punish severely not only Miller, but also those of the clansmen who openly sympathized with him. That the chief was a magistrate, as well as the landlord of the township, placed him in a position where it was comparatively easy to carry out his purpose. It was of the fugitive Miller that Michael Roddy was speaking to the score of settlers who were gathered at the home of John Moore MacIntyre. He did wrong in the beginning, the man Miller did, in selling the timber. The timber belongs to the laird. How ken ye that, Michael Roddy? Came the slow voice of John MacIntyre. No word of the timber is there in the leases. Do ye doubt the word of the chief? Demanded Sandy Fisher, the incredulity in his tone bordering on anger. He was an old man with a flowing patriarchal beard. Then, argued MacIntyre in his deliberate way, why didna he have Miller arrested for selling the logs? The truth was, he dare not. Still more wrong was it for Miller to quit the grant after the laird had say his nay, persisted Roddy. Tuts, man, remarked James MacFarlane, the poor lad couldna have stayed and seen his bairns starve. Naught was there for them in the house but potatoes, and little enough of them too with winter coming on. MacFarlane was a keen-eyed little man, of a humorous turn of mind, but with a due allowance of Scotch stubbornness. He and MacIntyre were considered by the chief fully as disloyal as the fugitive Miller. As MacIntyre had indicated, the MacNab had not pressed the manner of the timber. Miller, though firm in his belief that he was standing on his rights, was yet willing to render his chief all due deference. Following the ancient custom, he had repaired to Canull Lodge and asked of the chief permission to leave the grant in search of work. The request had been haughtily refused. Miller, however, had no choice. His crops that year had been destroyed by a forest fire. Only a few days had he been at work in the neighboring township of Fitzroy when a constable, armed with a warrant signed by the chief as magistrate, arrested him and brought him to Canull Lodge. "You will find, my man, that you cannot disobey your lawful superiors," the chief remarked, as he made out the commitment papers, charging Miller with intending to leave the country while still owing a sum of money to MacNab of MacNab. For 2 months, Miller lay in jail at Perth, 70 miles from his home, fed by the charity of the sheriff. MacIntyre and MacFarlane, hearing of his plight, went his bail and secured his release. The day set for his trial came, but Miller, detained by bad roads and the heavy spring rains, found the case had gone against him by default, and that he himself had been heavily fined for contempt of court, and that the chief, who had been forced to pay the bonds himself, had immediately secured judgment against MacIntyre and MacFarlane for the amounts. Terrified by these convincing evidences of the power of MacNab, Miller had left the country for parts unknown. 'Twas not wise MacIntyre and MacFarlane to have signed the lad's bonds. 'Tis a no avail to fight the laird. He is a great man among the great ones of the land. Again I say it. Miller should not have gone, insisted Roddy, wagging his bearded chin emphatically. The devil take it, broke in a young, impatient voice, the voice of Peter, John McIntyre's stripling son. "Now, why should any freeborn man beg permission from the McNab? Be we serfs that all our comings and goings are under the eye of the laird?" Peter was a falcon-faced fellow of 20 years, with wavy black hair and blue eyes. The curve of his clear-cut lips and the set of his sharp chin showed something of the insolence of a spoiled child and the dauntlessness of the race of mountain men. His was a face of heroic intensity, betokening a will, masterful for good if he might, for evil if he must. "It has aye been so. A good clansman should pay his chief the courtesy of asking him when he is going away," maintained Roddy. The young man's eyes snapped. His smile was contemptuous. "Oh, a curse on the old ways," he retorted. "Will they clear a fallow or feed a hungry baby?" It was the voice of youth that will ever be served, decrying the wisdom of age. Sandy Fisher lowered his head and gazed over his square, horn-rimmed spectacles almost sorrowfully at the young man. "You be a fine lad, Peter, but still a lad. More caution and respect for your elders would better become your years. There be three things any decent man respects: God, the king, and the chief." "Oh, law is a bad business for poor folks as we be," grumbled Roddy. "We canna fight the great. We shouldna be like the poor fools of the 45. "Michael Roddy," said John Moore McIntyre's voice, vibrant with indignation, "no man under my roof may speak with disrespect to the men who fought for the Bonnie Prince. Guard your tongue, man." "Good, good." The chorus of commendation was emphatic but undemonstrative. For still dear to the hearts of the Highlanders of McNab was the memory of the gallant young prince for whom their fathers had fought and suffered. "But Roddy is right, John Moore," old man Fisher asserted boldly. "I would gang both of you to the chief and very humbly ask his pardon. He is not small-hearted, the chief. He'll give you time to pay the bonds. You canna fight him. For 6 months now, you and James here have been dodging the process servers, and in the end, they will clap the blister on you both. The law and the chief and the government are all agin you." "Well," drawled McFarlane with a dry grin, "they ha' no clapped any blister on me yet, and I'll no' ask the chief's pardon." "Oh, curse your law, Roddy," burst out Alex Stewart, a fair-faced young man of 19. "Was it not the law that has made you, McFarlane, and you, John Moore, live in fear and trembling? Curse! Laddie, laddie," the soothing voice of John McIntyre cut short the boy's outburst. "Curse not at all. Curses like chickens have I a fashion of coming home to roost." But Stewart would not be restrained. Rising to his feet, he said defiantly, "Aye, I will say it. Curse the law and curse the laird. 'Tis but for the great the law stands. Does not the chief take from our lands the timber without a scratch of a pen to show that it's his? He'll no let the pathmasters build the bridge across the Madawaska at Burnstown with the improvement money from York. He says it is to be spent on the road to Alan Dew's clearing at White Lake. Has he not refused to take the day labour of McIntyre and McFarland's son in lieu of rent, though the lease says he shall do so? The man is a tyrant. 'Tis time." "Oh, God save all here," cried a cheery voice as the door was flung wide open. Murdy McGonagall, the blacksmith, stepped across the threshold. As his laughing blue eyes ranged around the room, at the flickering flames in the wide-open hearth and the half-concealed figures of the men seated in the shadows, he grinned broadly. "Ah, conspiring again your chief, are you?" he chuckled. Wah, 'tis meself that thanks the Lord that the Irish have no chiefs. 'Tis the one good thing the bloody Sassenach did for us. Kilt them all." The Scotchman smiled indulgently. McGonagall was a privileged character. His rollicking ways were well known in the Grant. Rising from the fireplace, where he had bent for a moment seeking a coal for his pipe, Murty caught sight of young Peter McIntyre, who stood with arms folded, leaning against the wall. "Oh, Peter, now that reminds me," began Murty as he thrust his hand into his blanket coat. "Sure, and I have a letter for you. 'Tis from the old terrier himself." Murty always referred to the chief as the old terrier. "Ah, sorra the good it can contain, for 'twas that devil's egg bag McTavish asked me to bring it." As Peter knelt on one knee in front of the hearth to peruse the missive, his sharp features, lit by the ruddy glow, filled with sudden indignation, and his fine dark eyes widened in amazement. "No, hearken, friends, to this. The chief accuses me of treason. In a voice trembling with exasperation, he read, Canal Lodge, May 27th, 1837. Peter McIntyre, degraded clansman. You were accused to me by Sir George Colborne of libel, sedition, and high treason. You will forthwith appear before me at my house of Kennel and there make submission. And if you show a contrite and repentant spirit and confess your fault against me, your legitimate chief, and your crime against Her Majesty Queen Victoria, I will intercede for your pardon. Your offended chief, McNab. In the room was a deep and portentous silence. Save perhaps Murty McGonagall, not a man but realized the seriousness of the accusation. For the last 3 years, the Canadas had been rife with agitation and discontent. Rumors had reached the Grant of the struggle that the reformers in the parliaments of the two provinces had been waging against the tyranny of Sir Francis Bond Head and the maladministration of the group of aristocratic families in whose hands the government lay, the Joneses, the Sherwoods, the Macaulays, and the Hagermans, all closely connected by marriage and consanguinity, and known to their opponents as the Family Compact. That the leaders of the reformers had, in their bitterness, threatened armed resistance to the authorities, that they had been denounced by the government press as rebels, traitors, and malcontents, and that several of them were now behind prison bars, were facts well known even to these settlers in the backwoods of the Ottawa Valley. To these expatriated Highlanders, many of whose grandfathers had died on the scaffold, the very word treason was fraught with fateful significance. They all knew the fiery spirit of Peter McIntyre. Was it not possible that some of his hasty words had reached the ears of the chief? Possibly Peter himself was in league with the leaders of the reformers, Papineau and Mackenzie. In John McIntyre's troubled eyes, as he gazed anxiously at his son, was an unspoken question. On my word, said Peter slowly, I ken not of what he means. No word ha' I said agin the Queen or the government. Ye ha' clashed agin the Laird, and he is the chief of the Clan MacNab. That ye cannot deny, said Roddy regretfully. To his mind it was much the same thing. Peter sprang to his feet, the letter crumpled in his fist. His defiant voice rang out. Again the chief and his ways I ha' spoke and I will. But I will give the lie in the teeth of any man that calls me traitor or rebel. Murty McGonagall, his short clay pipe up-tilted in his mouth, had been watching Peter, delight dance in his eyes. Suddenly he said, Ah, be aisy, bye, be aisy. 'Tis myself that can someone explain this letter. I come up with old Duncan Cameron and Hans Grogshop in the village this afternoon, and he told me the whole business. Someone has writ a letter to the governor, saying horrid things against the government and agin the old tarrier, with no name signed to it at all. And the governor's secretary, of course, sent it to the chief, and when the old tarrier gets it, he swore like a fishwife, and he shows it to Cameron and Alan Dew. And Alan, bad cess to his dirty soul, then and there put the notion into the chief's head that it was one of the McIntyres that writ it. And says the chief, 'Twas no John that did it, 'twas his brat Peter. 'Tis plain he thinks you wrote it by. Peter's face flushed with sudden passion. Then 'tis the doin' of that devil's spawn of the chief, Alan Dew, that black-hearted villain. 'Tis all a part of the same plot. Be a hunted man, and now I am called traitor. Oh, you make me shamed at heart of my Scottish blood. His voice rose to an impassioned scream. Our fathers kenned well how to deal with such tyrants in the days agone, and even the frog-eating Frenchman would not stand the tyrant King Louis. But here ye sit, night after night, haverin' and blethering about the rights of the chief. And that black-faced son of his, Alan Dew, there's not a comely woman in the Grant safe from that wolf. Ye talk of the law. What law is there for poor soft-witted Maggie McIntosh as she sits with a brat of Alan Dew on her knee, dreaming the poor daft creature that she be his wife by word of mouth as in the old land? Had we but the spirit of the wild rabbit of the woods, Alan Dew would have had a bullet in his dirty heart long since. Oh, keep yourself in hand, son. Talk not of violence. Violence, aye, he roared. I will talk of violence, for by God, if this be the work of Alan Dew, he held out the crumpled letter in his quivering fist, I'll make him eat his words or he'll die by my own hand. So saying, he strode out of the room, slamming the door behind him. The men, seated about the fire, shocked by the intensity of the lad's threat, sat upright, staring at one another in consternation. Fisher pursed his lips deprecatingly. Roddy was shaking his head in despair. Even Murty hurried to the door and looked out into the moonlight.
That was Lynn Stewart reading from Percival J. Cooney's Serfs No More, or The Kinsman, a novel published in 1916 and loosely based on the life and times of Archibald MacNab, the reputed last Laird of MacNab. Much of the true factual history of the real Archibald MacNab and his doings in Renfrew County in the early 19th century did finally get cleared up in 1988 when local historian Peter Hessel wrote what goes a long way to be considered the definitive history of the original MacNab Township. It was Mr. Hessel, as it were, who sorted out much of the factual wheat from the fictional chaff that had been mixed into the conventional biographies and romanticized fictions associated with Archibald MacNab. Here's a sampling of Hessel's work, read by Kathy Chepesky.
The name MacNab is said to come from the Gaelic word Macanab, son of the abbot, referring to the alleged founder of the clan, the abbot of St. Fillian's Monastery in Glendochart. In the 8th century, an abbot was a feudal landowner as well as a spiritual head of a monastery, and the old Celtic church did not stipulate celibacy. In 1336, the first undoubted Laird of MacNab, Gilbert MacNab of Beauvain and of that ilk, received a charter under the Great Seal. The MacNab motto is Timor Omnis Abesto, literally, let fear be far from all, i.e., fear nothing. It is often translated from the Latin as dreadnought, for example, on a seal which the Laird used for his correspondence in 1847. A carved copy of the MacNab coat of arms, fashioned by the Laird's great-grandson, Commander Nettle, after a drawing received from the Lord Lyon, King of Arms in Edinburgh, is at the Wabba Cottage Museum. The coat of arms includes a severed bearded head, a reference to a gory raid the MacNabs made on the last Naish family in the 17th century. Archibald Seal, whose wax impression can be found on many of his letters, also included the Naish's head. On the coat of arms reproduced on the cover of The Last Laird, the Naish's head was replaced by a severed arm holding a sword. The Clan MacNab's proud tradition is amply documented in a number of publications. Some of the clan's chiefs were colorful figures, appearing somewhat larger than life in generosity, aggressiveness, and love of tradition. Some were also characterized by their lack of financial judgment. The Last Laird of MacNab was written by Dugald C. MacNab in the 1870s and published in 1899 by Alexander Fraser, who later served as Ontario archivist. Archibald MacNab, the founder of MacNab Township, was born at Beauvain, Glendochart, Scotland, sometime between 1778 and 1781. He was the only son of his fairly affluent parents, Anne Moll and Robert MacNab, also of Beauvain, and who died in 1814. 4 months after the death of the Laird's father, his only sister, Anne Moll MacNab, was married to lawyer Robert Jameson of Edinburgh and also died. Archibald's first cousin was Canadian-born Alan Napier MacNab, later Sir Alan, who in 1854 became Premier of the United Canadas. He was also a railway magnate and military leader. Much of the information about the man who founded MacNab Township in Canada, Archibald MacNab, comes from a source that has to be regarded with extreme caution, Roland Wilde's book, MacNab, The Last Laird, published in 1938. Presented as a factual account, not as historical fiction, this book nevertheless is full of unsubstantiated anecdotal material which does not stand up to scrutiny. For unknown reasons, its author took it upon himself to blend fact and fiction liberally. Because of its pretense as a serious study, the book has been widely quoted and must be held responsible for some misconceptions about Archibald MacNab and his turbulent life in Canada. As one contemporary reviewer remarked, the book, hovers between anecdote and exposition, argument and commemoration, and on the whole is amateurish. The index is not to be trusted, nor is the bibliography apparently, since no one can find out from it where Mr. Wilde found his numerous quotations from Dougal MacNab, the Laird's right-hand man. Another book of interest is the historical novel Kinsman, written by Percival J. Cooney, published in 1916. Cooney grew up in or near Arnprior, where his father John managed the Wabba vineyard and orchard, though it was not in Wabba but near Wabba Creek in Fitzroy Township. For inspiration, Cooney turned to Dougal C. MacNab's The Last Laird of MacNab, with which he was acquainted and which he believed to be authored by Alexander Fraser, and so turned it into romantic fiction. Archibald's early education was by Presbyterian schoolmasters. Later, he set out to learn the law. It is not clear whether he actually studied law or was only apprenticed to a lawyer where he learned the loopholes of the law. He spent some time in London and Paris, though it should be noted that both Roland Wilde and the Dictionary of Canadian Biography described him during this time in his life as a drunkard, braggart, and whoremaster, though there is little evidence whatever to support such a characterization. In the voluminous documentary sources consulted in the course of this study, not even a hint of alcoholism or sexual promiscuity has been found to corroborate the claims in Wilde's extraordinary book. Perhaps about 1802, Archibald married Margaret Robertson of Edinburgh, whose father was a writer to the Signet and whose mother was a Murdoch of Garlancaber. Margaret and Archibald had 6 children over a period of 14 years. Their daughter Sarah Ann was born on November 3rd, 1803, and lived to be 91. Their son Alexander was born in 1817, died in 1828 at the age of 11. Son William, born around 1813, died in 1833 at the age of 20. Daughter Margaret died also quite young in 1834, though her age is not known. And 2 other children died in infancy. Archibald succeeded to the chiefship when his glamorous uncle, Francis XII or XVI, depending on whose reckoning is applied, Laird of MacNab, died in 1816. Raeburn's portrait of Chief Francis MacNab, made famous because it is prominently featured on bottles of Dewar's Highland whiskey, is often mistaken for a portrait of Archibald. At that time of his succession in 1816, Archibald was in his mid-30s and may have inherited perhaps the emptiest title in the Highlands, if not becoming the most impoverished chief in Scotland, owing £35,000, while his annual income, including rentals, amounted to about £1,000. Or as one source suggested, that since the estates were so considerably encumbered, he was obliged to sell his property to pay off his creditors. At any rate, it may have come as a surprise and great disappointment to Archibald that his uncle's estate was so hopelessly encumbered. Archibald MacNab made desperate efforts to refinance. Accordingly, he sold his Scottish Arnprior estates to a cotton spinner and cloth manufacturer for £80,000, though some suggest he squandered most of those proceeds in Paris. However, in view of his hopeless financial situation, it is doubtful that Archibald had such an enormous sum at his disposal, or that indeed he was able to realize any cash from property sales. It is more likely that most of what he received had to be paid to his creditors. In 1823, a writ of foreclosure was then issued against much of his remaining property. It's been suggested that he made an effort to sell the remainder, but he could not find a purchaser. However, this is contradicted by documentary evidence which shows that Archibald was in Canada as early as December 1822. It seems certain that the remaining lands were sold in 1828 to the 4th Earl of Breadalbane, the principal creditor. They included Kinnell House, the farms of Sleac, Ockham, Bovin, and Cratcher, the Grey Street and Clatchegg houses, and parts of the village of Killin, together with the superiorities over Ewer, Suey, Craignavy, and Arnfinlay. Even the islands in the Dochart River, Garbimnas and Inchbuie, the latter containing the burial ground of the Clan MacNab, were sold. The contents of Canal House were included in the sale. They were shown to visitors of the house until auctioned off in 1935. The Laird left for Canada not in 1823, as is often stated, but in 1821 or 1822. His wife had left him with her children sometime prior to his departure for Canada, and they may have separated as early as 1819. Erroneously, it is sometimes stated that the Laird left his wife and daughter behind. It appears that when the Laird left Scotland, a number of people came with him. One source said that John Buchan, a faithful servant of Dr. Hamilton in Scotland, accompanied Archibald to Canada and stayed at Point Fortune, where he became a respectable and wealthy farmer. The same source stated that Peter McIntyre also came with the Laird. Others, including Dugald C. MacNab, the writer of The Last Laird, and who had been a very young secretary to the Laird before turning against him, undoubtedly came out to Canada as well, but much later, and not with the original group. There is no doubt that Archibald considers himself to be the 13th Laird of MacNab. Dugald C. MacNab and his contemporaries also took for granted that he was indeed the last chieftain of the MacNabs and the last legitimate chief of the Clan MacNab. Many others also acknowledged Archibald as the 13th Laird and concluded, "The next MacNabs by descent entitled to the chiefship are believed to be Sir Alan Napier MacNab, who resides in Canada, Dr. Robert MacNab of the 5th Fusiliers, and Mr. John MacNab of Glenmavis Bathgate." And though Archibald Corey MacNab assumed the chiefship of the modern clan in 1954, Archibald of MacNab Township fame was called the last acknowledged chieftain of the clan. According to this source, Archibald's first wife, when hearing that he had died in 1860, said, "Then I am MacNab." She assumed the triple plumes of chiefship, and after her, the plumes nodded on the head of her sole surviving daughter, Sarah Ann, until her death in 1894. Others wrote that those contemporary MacNabs who were alive back then were not particularly happy to be reminded of their last chieftain. "There are," said one, "indeed, those who say that Archibald was only recognized as chief, the implication being that there was some doubt as to his right to succeed. Apparently, his father, Francis, had left no written statement regarding Archibald's inherited right to chiefship. There have been stories of family papers concealed or destroyed, of proofs that his uncle was secretly married, and a series of claimants to the chiefship. But the MacNabs have now been without a chief for a century." In some accounts, Archibald is referred to as the 17th instead of the 13th Laird. His great-grandson, Commander Stanley Archibald Nettle, explains, "Francis was the 12th and last lineal Laird of MacNab. Thus, Archibald was the 13th. Nettle explains that he bases his opinion on British newspaper reports, on a brief history of MacNab, on Colonel Alexander Fraser's book, and on other Canadian sources. However, this question has now been settled by British authorities. Nettle also writes, "He is described as the last Laird because he was the last of the direct line and the last of the feudal Lairds." According to the Scottish Tartan Society at Broughty Castle, Dundee, Scotland, Archibald Corey MacNab was the 22nd chief, and who had recovered the ancient family seat of Canal. Nettle explains how the transition between Archibald the 13th, or 17th, Laird, and Archibald Corey, the 22nd chief, came about. "To be chief, one must be officially recognized by the Lord Lion, King of Arms, and my grandmother and her descendants did not wish to. Then Archibald Corey MacNab in 1954 claimed to be descended from a younger son of Finlay in the 1600s, and he counted his own ancestors as de jure chiefs. He also claimed to have found some of the earlier accounts incorrect, although some is surmise, and he rewrote this in showing Francis as 16th Laird, and then with the de jure chiefs he counted himself the 22nd. The Clan Society seems to have accepted this and published it, but to me it is a nonsense. Yet Commander Nettle is a life member of the Clan MacNab Society, which was founded in 1904 and has branches in several countries. Chief Archibald Corey MacNab was born around 1887 and was a British civil servant who retired in 1946 after 35 years as an administrator in India. He managed to buy back a substantial portion of MacNab's Killin estate in 1949, including Kinnell House, from Lord Breadalbane after it had been in Breadalbane hands for 121 years. In 1954, Archibald Corey MacNab then succeeded in convincing the Lord Lyon, King of Arms, that he was in fact the legitimate chief. He received a grant of the original arms, which had not been matriculated for many generations.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading from Peter Hessel's MacNab Township History. Not too surprisingly, as Hessel himself discovered, the last Laird of MacNab wasn't, in fact, the last Laird of MacNab. That too apparently was a big fib. Here's Karen Philip Kousty with more details taken from the Ottawa Journal.
From the March 20th, 1954 edition of the Ottawa Journal, headlined, Restoring of Clan MacNab Title Recalls Stormy Madawaska Days, by Harry J. Walker. Archibald Corey MacNab, the presumed 14th chief of MacNab, after arriving in Scotland from India, bought Kinnell House, the historic seat of the clan on the Dochart, near the castle which the English destroyed 300 years ago. He also petitioned the crown for the restoration of the coat of arms of his clan, the gory head of MacNeish, with its motto, Dread Not. Thus, after 100 years, history has come full cycle. Redeemed is the proud clan heritage, which another Archibald, the 13th Laird, squandered in the courts of Europe and finally in defeat in our Madawaska, Ottawa wilderness. There is a splendid township in Renfrew County named after this tattered titan who tried to establish a kingdom in the triangle of the Madawaska and the Ottawa. In the town of Armprior, the 13th Laird built his own Kinnell Lodge in 1831 in memory of his last ancestral house on the Dochart in Scotland. He also named a brawling creek nearby the Dochart. Also at White Lake are the stone remains of Wabba Lodge, which he built with forced labor as an outpost in the Madawaska hinterland and where he spent his last Canadian days. That chief died unhonored and unsung in a Brittany fishing village. Yet it will be the reclamation of a lot of history when the present Archibald Corey MacNab becomes the 14th chieftain of a great clan.
It would take another 13 years after that Ottawa Journal story for that more recent last Laird of MacNab to actually show up along the Madawaska in MacNab-Braeside Township. But Archibald Corey MacNab did do just that in 1967, according to another Ottawa Journal article, again read by Karen Filipkowski.
From the July 6, 1967 edition of the Ottawa Journal, headlined, The MacNab Winds Up Area Visit, Armprior. Chief Archibald Corey MacNab, Laird of the Clan MacNab, left Ottawa today for Hamilton after a goodwill visit to Armprior and the MacNab Township. The chief spent most of the past week attending official functions, presiding at formal openings of centennial projects, and helping soothe old sores stemming from the era of the founding of Armprior 125 years ago under the infamous last Laird of MacNab. The present chief, who claims to be only a distant relation of the old despot, spoke kindly of MacNab Township and its people, and he and his wife Dame Alice invited anyone from MacNab Township to visit them at home in Scotland. On Friday, they dined at St. Teresa's Novitiate of the Oblate Order, where once stood Kinnell Lodge, the pioneer home of the original Laird. On Sunday, the chief, assisted by Reeve George MacLean of MacNab, officiated at the formal ribbon-cutting ceremony opening MacNab Municipal Hall at Glasgow Station. The function was attended by some 500 people, including Federal Agricultural Minister Joe Green and Paul Jakubowski, MLA for Renfrew South.
Sadly, Archibald Corey MacNab passed away in 1970, but he too, as it turns out, was not the last Laird of MacNab. his son, James Charles McNab, had that mantle of the last lairdship of McNab thrust upon him until more recently, until 2013, when, upon James's own death, he passed it on to his son, James William Archibald McNab, who thus became the 24th chief of the Clan McNab. And thankfully, in 2019, Clan Chief James William Archibald McNab, along with a fulsome delegation of Clan McNab International, made a pilgrimage to Wahba Cottage Museum and Garden. All to say, at this very moment, there appears to be no last Laird of McNab in sight. And so there you have it, the story of the last Laird of McNab, or as best as we can make it in 2023, given 200 years of Scottish hijinks in Renfrew County that started way back in 1823, when Archibald McNab hightailed it in from Robbie Burns's country. But lest you think that's the end of the story, know that we, here at the Opiongo Line, along with those trusty vocal thespians of the Opiongo Readers Theatre, will not rest until we get to the very bottom of the last Laird's true history. So, stay tuned over the next 2 years as Archibald McNab's bicentenary approaches. Better still, why not drop by the Wahba Cottage Museum and Gardens and have a chat with James Austin, the museum's curator, and a great help to us here putting together this show. Drop in and see for yourself what's become of the last Laird's ever-evolving reputation, including all that's good, all that's bad, and all that's just plain ugly. I'm Kristen Marchand, and along with Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Karen Filipkowski, Lynn Stewart, and our producer, Barry Conway, we wish you a great Robbie Burns Day and hope you get your fill of hot, steaming haggis and ice-cold single malt. Good day, and God bless.